The scripture reading for today is found in John chapter 20, verses 1 through 23. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, and said, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him." So Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Then Simon Peter, who was behind him, arrived and went into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the burial cloth that had been around Jesus' head. The cloth was folded up by itself, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went inside. He saw and believed. They still did not understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. Then the disciples went back to their homes, but Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. They asked her, "Woman, why are you crying?" "They have taken my Lord away," she said, "and I don't know where they have put him." At this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize that it was Jesus. "Woman," he said, "why are you crying? Who is it you are looking for?" Thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will get him." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned toward him and cried out in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me, for I have not yet returned to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am returning to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news, "I have seen the Lord." And she told them that he had said these things to her. On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together, with the doors locked for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After he said this, he showed them his hands and side. The disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. Again, Jesus said, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I am sending you." And with that, he breathed on them and said, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive anyone his sins, they are forgiven. If you do not forgive them, they are not forgiven." This is the word of the Lord.
Well, good afternoon. Yeah. We're going to get along a lot better if we can... Good afternoon. Oh, you see, it's so easy. Anybody else want to leave? No? We're okay. It's been an absolute delight to spend the day with the church here, to be at the services this morning. And yesterday, we had a seminar day together, and then earlier in the week I was doing some things, and tomorrow I go home. But it's been an absolute delight to be part of this church, even for a very short time. And it's a privilege to come and share the word of the Lord with you this afternoon. As was said earlier, I work for this group called the London Institute for Contemporary Christianity. We were formed 30 years ago by the ministry of a man called John Stott. Some of you may have heard of him, some of you won't be aware of who that was. But John Stott was one of the foremost evangelical leaders of the 20th century. But increasingly, as he got older, one of the things he became increasingly concerned about was the fact that it's quite possible to be Bible-believing, church-attending, and yet unable to see how that world, the world of the Bible and church, actually makes a difference in the Monday through to Saturday world. In other words, we can live a sacred, secular, divided life. Some things really seem to matter to God, and then there's the rest. And what John Stott wanted to do was to begin a movement, really, whereby Christians, so-called ordinary Christians, would get a sense of how God might use them in their everyday lives for his glory. And LICC, for 30 years, in different ways, have been trying to do that, to enable people to live out the consequences of the gospel in the lives that they live Monday through Saturday. This is my third time in America. I've been to Milwaukee. I'm not sure why that's funny. I've been to San Antonio, and I've been here. Someone suggested if I go to California, I've pretty much done it all. And on Thursday evening, Chris and Laura Lake, who have hosted me really well this week, they took me to a baseball game, my first baseball game. Now, in England, we have a game called cricket. You don't know how to play this game. And we didn't teach you because if we had taught you, you'd probably beat us at it. So we thought we'd leave you out. But essentially, cricket is a game that goes on for hours with minutes of excitement. Hours of boredom and minutes of excitement. In fact, in cricket, and this will be a real strange thing for some of you, the game, one game, can last 5 days. And if it rains on the fifth, we call it a draw. Doesn't even finish. It's good to know that you have a similar game with hours of boredom and minutes of excitement, and you call it baseball. I was in Fenway Park with Chris and Laura and 35,000 other people who seemed to be having a ball. And I was sitting there, no idea what's actually happening. I didn't even really know if the game had started or not. It was like... And Chris, bless him, I'm sitting next to Chris, and he's trying to explain what lights mean, green lights, red lights, and what the statistics mean, and all of that. And I am asking increasingly stupid questions. And there's a guy sitting in front of us, and after a while, he turns around and he said, "Excuse me, sir, I don't want to appear xenophobic." And I thought, you can tell you're in Boston. And I wondered what was going to come next. Like, go home, I mean. And he said, "Is this by any chance your first baseball game?" And I said to him, "How could you tell?" Because Chris had bought me a baseball hat. I just wanted to blend in. But that guy was listening to my questions and hearing my responses and recognizing I was completely bemused by pretty much everything that was going on. And he could tell, this guy behind me doesn't get my culture. He just doesn't understand. John Stott was really concerned on two levels, really. One is that either we become so accustomed to our culture that we lose the cutting edge of the gospel, or we become so accustomed to the church culture that we find it increasingly difficult to communicate that in a wider culture. And he had a phrase that he used a lot. He called it double listening. That you're called to listen to the word, but you're also called to listen to the world. You can't cut yourself off into small sectarian groups, but neither can you lose connection with the word. What I want to do is reflect with you about the first day that we read about. One of your writers has said this: anyone can be sentimental about the nativity. Any fool can feel like a Christian at Christmas, but Easter is the main event. If you don't believe in the resurrection, you're not a believer. John Irving has Owen Meany say in that novel. And he's right. The thing that marks us out is a profound sense that at one time in our history, God raised Jesus from the dead, and he ascended, and he is the Lord of all. It was the first day. the day of resurrection. When John writes his gospel, he writes carefully and he writes artfully. John does not simply retell the story of Jesus' life without any consequence. He thinks about how can he bring this material together in a way that will be both symbolic and rich and will cause you to wonder. So it's no surprise that John begins his gospel like this. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. This is John retelling the Genesis story in the beginning. And when John gets to retelling the story of the resurrection, he begins his chapter by allowing you to see and hear the echoes of the first chapter early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark. Light shone. The first day of new creation. The first day of recreation. While it's still dark, while the world has no idea of the riches of all that's going to happen next, on the first day of the week, while it's still dark, Mary visits a tomb and discovers. Well, you know what she discovered. She discovered an empty tomb. And Mary is no fool. Mary knows that dead men don't rise from the dead. One of the things that non-Christians say about us is, well, of course, you're building your life and your faith around superstition. And earlier generations were more gullible. Please believe me. People in the first century knew that dead men stay dead. If you were executed by the Romans, they were efficient. The Romans knew how to execute people efficiently and finally. Mary's no fool. She knows that dead men don't rise. She knows that dead bodies stay in place. She knows she can come and deal with Jesus' body. So when she finds it's gone, she can only assume that someone has taken that body, because otherwise the natural order has been overturned. Otherwise the world is a different place. Otherwise the power of God has invaded and rescued from death the final power, his only son. If Jesus has risen from the dead, this is a new day, a day of new creation. Nothing can be the same again. Let me put it really succinctly. If Jesus died and stayed dead, his story was complete. However, if Jesus died and rose again, his story continues. And if his story is continuing, he wraps me and you into it. And says, I want you to be part of my story. Because I have not finished. It's a day of resurrection. The first day was also a day of relationship. Some of you may well have had the experience of losing someone who's very close to you. And you know what it feels like to be overwhelmed with grief. And Mary, on that day, initially is overwhelmed with grief. And she's in the garden and she's crying and she's aware of someone behind her. And she says, sir, she She thought he was a gardener. She said, "Sir, if you've moved Jesus and you've taken his body somewhere, please tell me where he is, for I will visit him." And at that moment, she hears a voice that she suddenly recognizes, and the voice simply says, "Mary." Says her name. And she turns and realizes it's Jesus and calls him Rabboni, teacher. And she wants to hold on to him. And Jesus says, "Don't hold on to me, for I've not yet returned to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. And you have a task to do. I want you to go and tell the other disciples what you have seen." And there's two things I want to say. Firstly, it's this. The task of humanity is not to seek after God. God seeks after humanity. God comes looking for us. And he knows you by name. And he calls you by name. And he waits for you to respond to him. And he knows the names of your family who do not know him. And your work colleagues. And your housemates. And your friends. He knows their name. Longing for them to turn to find him. And the second thing is that Mary is told, commissioned, to go and tell the other disciples. And it's easy for us to miss the impact of that. You may know that in the first century, at that time, for a woman to be given that sort of commission to go and tell the men was deeply countercultural. Because normally in that setting, the woman would not have been seen to have had the authority that men would have had. It was just the culture of the day. So it's intriguing that the first person who's told to go and tell the others about the resurrection of Jesus is someone who everybody else may well have said, "Who do you think you are? Let's have someone with a bit more authority around here, please." Your city is an interesting city, and on Friday I had some free time, so I walked up to Harvard, a place that, in England we have old places like Oxford and Cambridge, so I wanted to see what a new university looked like in America. 1600, that's like yesterday for us. I'd heard a lot about it. And I'd seen sort of pictures on TV and things like that. And so I just wanted to go and see what it was like. And it was everything I expected it to be. The first two middle-aged men I saw walking through the sort of precincts of the university were wearing blazers, and they had bow ties on, and they looked like professors that I'd always imagined professors would look like. It was like a film set for me. And it was a beautiful afternoon, you might remember, on Friday. And I sat on one of the seats and had an ice cream and watched. I watched the brightest and the best of a young generation play ball and thought, "Shouldn't you be working?" I'd walked past MIT, recognizing that you're at the heart of global science and breakthrough. And some of you in the room are on the cutting edge of some of this city's work and some of the nation's work. Some of you are indeed the brightest and best. And yet, because actually scratches and we're all the same, in the room there's loads of us who feel everybody else is better than me. Everybody else is better than me. It doesn't really matter what exams you pass or what titles you get. Ultimately, we're all the same. None of us feel that confident. In fact, when Paul reflected on that, when he wrote to a church in Corinth, he said, you know what? God takes delight in using the people who are the very last people who might have been expected to be used by God. God overturns the cultural expectations by taking people who feel I'm the weakest here and uses them for his glory. And this afternoon, that could be you. Mary, go tell the others. The first day of the week was not only a day of resurrection and relationship, it was a day of recommissioning. John has us go through the day, and in the morning we have the story of Mary meeting Jesus, being sent. In the evening we have the story about how Jesus comes to his disciples who are huddled together in the room because they're afraid of the Jews. They're huddled together because they're afraid that the external culture would not receive them well. So they're together. And Jesus, on the first day, recommissions his disciples. He comes amongst them and breathes his spirit into them. And I think when you read that, you're supposed to remember other stories. You're supposed to remember stories like the creation of Adam in the Garden of Eden. Do you remember when God takes dust and forms Adam, but Adam becomes a man when God breathes his life into him? You're supposed to remember stories like the one found in Ezekiel, where Ezekiel has a vision of the people of God, and they just look like dry bones, scattered and useless. And yet he begins to see the dry bones coming together, tendon by tendon, and flesh coming upon them. And they begin to rise up to be an army, but they actually become an army only when life is breathed into them. Jesus comes amongst his own disciples and breathes life into them and says, "Receive my spirit." They are recommissioned on the first day. The first day of resurrection, the first day of relationship, the first day of recommissioning. We can think of today, Sunday, in the same way as everyone else does. I wonder what your neighbors thought when you came to church this morning. You didn't come this morning, you came this afternoon. But thank you for being so polite as for not pointing it out. Actually, talking about this morning, there was an 8:30 service, and I've got a feeling when those folks get to heaven, they're really going to be at the front of the queue. Followed by the 11 o'clock folks. But you'll be there eventually. You'll just need to wait a whole stack of time. Or maybe it's the other way around, because at least the 8:30 folks, they get it out of the way first, don't they? They have the rest of Sunday. Whereas you, it kind of messes up the middle of your day. Maybe you'll get the biggest reward. At least the 11 o'clock folks, they can go for lunch after. They'll be at the last of the line, I think. Now I think about it, I think definitely you'll be at the front. I think God will say, you've made the biggest sacrifice for me. Because I bet that's what your neighbors think. Seriously. Because I bet your neighbors think, why would you mess up the middle of your day? Or they might think, well, bless them. They go to church, I go to golf. I do yoga, they do church, whatever helps you get through. It's like, it's just leisure, isn't it? I bet that's what they think. I bet they think, well, some folks go to church, some folks don't. Whatever gets you through, because it's like the weekend. And some of you who have been here for a long time today, I bet some of you go, this doesn't feel much like a day of rest. But you know what the truth is? Today is the first day of the week. The rest of the world, they say, this is the last day of last week. Because your Google calendar will tell you that tomorrow is the first day of the week. But the Bible says today's the first day of the week. Now that's more than just mildly interesting. You see, today we gather. In the UK, those red dots represent the percentage of people who are gathering in church this month in the UK. That's the number of people, approximately, who will gather to worship Jesus once, at least once this month in the UK. 93% of people in the UK have decided that that's a ridiculous thing to do. Irrelevant, inappropriate. I wonder, when you look at that picture, how it makes you feel, because I suspect that picture is not that dissimilar to New England. Most of the people you spend most of the time with have decided that what you do is irrelevant to them. And so we look at the dots and we can easily feel that we're in the corner, that we're sort of sidelined, that we're marginalized. But actually, no. Today we gather like that. Today we worship. Today we allow our lives to be reshaped by the fact that Jesus is indeed Lord. You have sung this afternoon songs about how you are willing to surrender your lives to the Lordship of Jesus and a bigger purpose. That's the first thing you've done in this week, because Monday's the second day, and tomorrow you will get the opportunity to live that out. Today we gather and we're shaped by the things we love. Tomorrow, that's where you'll be tomorrow. Scattered. Scattered across the city, scattered across the region. And if you want to know what the letters stand for, they simply stand for full-time Christian workers. For that's what you are. I don't know when you looked, when you looked at that, that picture feels quite overwhelming, doesn't it? It's kind of like, how are we going to make a difference? You know? You've got some people on the front line who sort of like, you know, they can touch perhaps five gray dots. We can do some stuff with young people. We can do some stuff with the poor, etc. And you've got three people who are saying, we're right behind you. We're glad you're doing it. We're glad we belong to a missional church. Go for it. But that's where you will be on the second day, tomorrow. As the Father sent Jesus, so Jesus sends us by the power of the Spirit. And he breathes on us and says, you that spend your day tomorrow on the school gate, or on factory floors, or in office blocks. On Friday, when I was walking up to Harvard, I spent some time, I did the Freedom Trail, walked on along the Freedom Trail, which I found really interesting. And, you know, as I don't know, if you want to reconsider that whole relationship, we take you back again. We know you walked out on us, but we'd have you back. I'll leave you to consider that. But from there, I walked up, as I said, I walked to Harvard. And as I was walking, this guy was running down. There was a whole stack of people running, but this guy particularly, he was running towards me. And you know how, when you see that, I'm no scientist, but I understand basic physics. So you get out of the way, you know? And as I did, he kind of moved towards me, and I'm now thinking, you know, maybe he wants English lessons, I don't know. But so we're dancing a little, and he stops and he takes out his earplugs and he says, I was at the meeting you were speaking on Thursday morning, the men's breakfast. So we got chatting. And he comes to this church. And he works on oil rigs. It's not what I expected. He works on oil rigs. He's 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. And we talk together about what it means to be a Christian working in such close proximity to a community of people who you work with on an oil rig for 2 weeks. Live, work, spend all of your time for 2 weeks. Your church has a ministry to oil rig workers, as it does wherever you might find yourself. And there you're learning to be a disciple. You're learning to live the way of Jesus. A disciple, and it's more than this, but never less than this. A disciple is someone who is learning to live the way of Jesus in their context at this moment. This is what it means to follow Jesus. This is why we're here today, because actually we're not only committing our lives to him again, but we're actually saying, Jesus, will you shape us so we might understand what it means to follow you? Because it's not a one-off. These guys, when they were getting baptized, they were great, weren't they? The little lad who said, I'm not taking my hands out of my pockets for this. I know it's a big deal, but I'm just not going to take my hands out. It's fine. Just baptize me with my hands in my pocket. And it was said over them. I can't remember whether it was Chris or whether it was their dad, but someone said, they will learn what it means to keep on, and these are my words, not theirs, but to keep on recommitting their lives. And of course they will. But so do I. And so do you. The first time you get a job, it's a new context and you learn again. What does it mean to follow Jesus in this context? The first time you get married, what does it mean to be a disciple of Jesus now? You have a child. You become a grandparent. You're given more responsibility at work for other people. Your leisure club makes you the president of whatever it may be. It is the moment where you have a context in which you are learning yet again. What does it mean to be a disciple of Jesus right now? And we're a congregation this afternoon of a wide range of ages. And some of us are older than some of you. I was told this was a contemporary service, and so they said you can dress down a little bit. So I took the robe off, I took the tie off. I don't know if I've gone too far. I was thinking about the jeans that only come halfway up my in the baseball cap. That's still in the room. Some of you are 25 years old. And you're having to learn, what does it mean to be a disciple of Jesus at the age of 25 when you're making significant decisions about your future? And some of you are 55 years old. And when you're 55, you begin to see those who are younger than you overtaking you. What does it mean to be a disciple of Jesus then? This is what it means to be a disciple. We've been thinking a lot about this at LICC, and when you came in, did you receive a little card? There were some little people who were giving them out, and they were doing a good job. It refers to this. We've suggested a framework. What does it mean to serve the Lord? What does it mean to be shaped on the first day for the second day, for Monday and the rest of the days? And we've suggested there's at least these things. You see, when people in congregations hear us talk like this, often what they think we mean is you've got to lever Jesus into the conversation, however artificially. The thing I have learned about Boston is that I'm going to, if I ever come again, and, you know, who knows? I may have blotted my copybook so badly that I can't come back again. But if I ever come back again, I'm going to come back 1 month later. It's too cold at the moment. It's too rainy. If I wanted that, I'd have stayed in Manchester. And some people think you've got to do it like that, you know? Your colleague or your friend says, God, it's cold today, and you've got to say things like, yes, it was exactly this cold when I first received Jesus as my personal savior. Now, you can try that, but you might find yourself without friends after a while. Now, please hear me. There are moments when you have to speak and you would want to speak and explain what it means to be a follower of Jesus. But actually, it's about the whole of your life. It's about you modeling godly character. There's a personal assistant that we know, a PA. She's a secretary, and she was a secretary to a very, very fearsome boss. He was a bully. And she used to come home crying very regularly from work. But every day she got up and she prayed, Dear Lord, help me today to be an agent of grace to my bully. And after 3 years, she quit. She'd had enough. And 6 months later, her colleagues, her ex-colleagues, rang her up and said, will you come and talk to the new staff? Because they're not coping at all. And she, who'd finished after 3 years feeling like a failure, said, I didn't cope. And they said, you were the only one that looked like you were coping. Does God answer the prayer, may I be an agent of grace? What does it mean to make good work? There's a lady in the congregation called Ruth who's just hiding under the pew, really quite strangely. I'm kind of hoping she's just shy on and not died or anything. And Ruth was an event I was at Friday evening, and she's still there. And we were walking back to the city, and she was going for a car. And one of the things I've noticed about Boston is car park spaces are really expensive. You should park in Manchester. In the UK, it's much cheaper. To be honest, even with the flight. And I was saying to Ruth, she was telling me where she'd parked a car because she found somewhere that was more reasonable. But she came to the first work life group that was held here in the church, and she's been thinking through how God might use her. And this isn't her own church. She goes to another church normally. She's just come this evening to be embarrassed. But in her place up in Cambridge where she lives, she started another group. And she was telling me this story. One of the guys in her work life group in Cambridge owns a car park. And he's been thinking through what it means to be an agent of the gospel at work, and he's brought all his prices down because he said, I don't need to capitalize on everybody else. Now, some of you are thinking two things at this point. One, where is that car park? And two, is the man a fool? What does it mean to engage in a culture and say, actually, I'm going to make good work for the sake of the common good? It's not just about individualism, but actually, how do I work for the sake of my community? What does it mean to minister grace and love? What does it mean to mold a culture? You are the salt of the earth. What does it mean to be salt and light? What does it mean to be a mouthpiece for truth and justice? What does it mean to be a messenger of the gospel? Some of you will be deciding what careers you want to go into. Can I urge you, those of you that love the Lord the most, don't assume that the best way you can serve him is by working for a church. Don't feel second class because you're not working for a parachurch organization. Please follow the gifting and the calling of God for the sake of the world as a disciple of His who seeks to make a difference wherever you find yourself. I'm nearly through. Let me just finish by reminding you of this. When Paul writes to the Philippians, he writes to a people and he says to them, "Work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for God works in you to will and to act according to His good purpose." Continue to work out your salvation because God's at work in you. And then he goes on and he makes it really, really down to earth. Do everything without grumbling or arguing so that you might become blameless and pure, children of God without fault in a warped and crooked generation. What does it mean to be people who recognize that they have a front line that God has called them to minister on, a place where you're engaged with a world that sees faith as irrelevant and having nothing to do with them? On the first day, the world changed. On the first day, the day of resurrection, the world changed. On the first day, you and I were invited into a relationship with the Creator of the world. None of us are excluded. And if you're not sure whether you've accepted that, if you're not sure that you have that relationship with God, hear Him calling your name, inviting you to surrender to Christ for the sake of His world. On the first day, you were recommissioned as an agent of the kingdom to bear fruit wherever you might find yourself. The cards are simply there in that they might help you pray on the second day, tomorrow, on Monday. I want you to take a moment just to find someone who looks fairly intelligent around you. If you need to move, then you need to move. I'm only joking, don't move, you'll offend them. I've done this before. Just quickly turn to them and share with them what's the one thing that the Englishman said that is worth remembering. Okay, what's the one thing the Englishman said that's worth remembering? Now, the way this works is you have to look at the person next to you. That's how it begins. If you're shy, say, "You go first." And pray that they speak a long time and I'll break off before you get a chance. What's the one thing? I'm sorry not to have asked you that at the beginning because some of you weren't realizing that you were supposed to listen. What's the one thing you've heard that's worth taking away? Just think about that and then tell your neighbor. Go. I'm really hoping that the buzz of conversation wasn't it a tragedy about Thursday evening at the ball game when the New York Yankees won. I'm really hoping it's not just that. May you know the grace of God as you seek to be a follower of Jesus, that you might live as light in a dark world, as you seek to serve the kingdom and the purpose of God in all you do.